It's election time again at WBAI. The nominating period for vacant seats on the local station board is open until June 30th. In order to be eligible to run for a seat or to cast a vote in the upcoming election, you must be a member who has paid at least $25 membership between July 1st, 2015 and June 30th, 2016, or have volunteered 3 hours during the same period, or have received a hardship waiver. Your local station needs your support. You can meet the candidates and sign a nominating petition at Brooklyn Commons, located at 388 Atlantic Avenue, on June 17th, 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., or on June 22nd, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. For more information, visit elections.pacifica.org or call 646-535-4059.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to.
Peace. Oh my God, hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God, hear my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God, hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God, oh my God. Liberté,
investigative journalist Alan Nairn will speak at 6 p.m. on Saturday, June 18th at Haiti Liberté, 1583 Albany Avenue in Brooklyn. In 1994, Alan Nairn broke the story that FRAP Death Squad leader Toto Constant was a paid agent of the CIA in Haiti. In 1991, in East Timor, Indonesian soldiers beat Nairn and fellow journalist Amy Goodman after they witnessed a massacre of Timorese demonstrators. In the 1980s, Nairn reported on the death squads in Guatemala and El Salvador. Alan Nairn will speak on the situation today in Haiti, Indonesia, and Guatemala, as well as on the U.S. presidential elections. That's Saturday, June 18th at 6 p.m. at Haiti Liberté, 1583 Albany Avenue, corner of Glenwood Road in Brooklyn, New York. For more information, call 718-421-0162. 718-421-0162.
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
Yeah. be.
You're listening to WBAI Radio in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis, sharing the studio with
Paulette Spencer.
And we welcome all of you who are tuned in to this program, Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And so we're here live in the studio. We have an opportunity to converse with those of you who would like to join us by phone. The number, jot it down if you don't know it already, 718-780-8888. And we'll give that out again. And we will proceed. Last week I was talking about my research project. So I'm still working on it, having a wonderful time with it. And I was able to download a document of an earlier explorer, Giovanni Verrazzano. And he explored in the 1500s. He was one of the very early explorers. What is interesting about him, I discovered, that he was actually a pirate. One of the reasons he was so versed in the coastline of the American continent is because he would wait for the Spanish ships to come out with their gold, and then he would take it from them and then take it. He was actually working for France at the time. So I find that very interesting. But what's even more interesting is in his, I guess it's his journal or his document of his voyages, he has a piece here that I wanted to read because I find it kind of interesting. The first landing and the first indigenes, I-N-D-I-G-E-N-E-S is what they call, he calls it. I like that word, actually. I don't like the word aboriginal so much because it's like, what does abor mean but abhor? So I find that word suspect. But indigenes, a little bit more palatable for me. But he says this, we were on land, and that which we were able to learn of their life and customs, I will tell your majesty briefly. They go nude of everything, except that they wear some skins and little animals like martens, a girdle of fine grass, woven with, let me go to the next page, woven with various tails of other animals, which hang around the body as far as the knee, the rest nude and head likewise. They wear certain garlands of feathers of birds. And this is the part that I like. They are of dark color, not much unlike the Ethiopians, and hair black and thick, not very long, which they tie together back on the head in the shape of a little tail. I thought that was interesting. As for the symmetry of the man, they are well proportioned of medium stature and rather exceed us. In the breast they are broad, their arms well built, the legs and other parts of the body well put together. There is nothing else except that they incline somewhat to broadness in the face, but not all, for in more we saw the face clear cut, the eyes black and large, the glance intent and quick. And, you know, so I just thought that was interesting. He's describing the indigenous people that he found when he sent this document to the Majesty, His Royal Majesty, whomever that might be. I guess it's depending. And then he mapped. He actually mapped the continent in the 1500s, the eastern seaboard. And that map was recently found, I think, in the Vatican. So I thought that, so this is from 1524. And so I thought that that was interesting because the actual document itself was printed in 1916, but his records come from 1524. And I brought that up because I've been doing this research on the indigenous people of the Americas. Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, just based on family history and stories passed down, have known that many black people in this country have indigenous or native roots, as I would understand it. But the truth of it is, even from facially and the features of the people in my family, they're all dark-skinned people, though they're probably their features are more characteristic indigenous, with like sort of that long big nose, and but it's interesting in sort of that straightish wavyish hair. But I just find it interesting that as of late there has been an interesting effort to disengage African American so-called or black people from their roots in this country. And so I've been seeking to see if there's any evidence to the fact that America was peopled by red, black, yellow also. You know, people of various different shades and what might be considered racial stereotypes. And what happened during the advent of slavery in this country, a lot of people who were free because they were here, They were not imported from Africa, so were considered free blacks here in America. But a lot of them, as the laws systematically were changed, they were sort of squeezed into a state of not having any liberties, and many people were taken into slavery or sold into slavery and lost their properties. And so I feel that there is a history that has been submerged, I guess it would be the word, because to say hidden or unknown would suggest that it was lost by accident. I don't think it was lost by accident. I think that there's an organized and orchestrated purposeful rewriting of history. And I see it in a lot of archaeological documents where archaeologists always explain away, not always, but for the most part, try to explain away the extreme diversity that was present in the Native American continent here. So I thought that was, when I saw that, I thought that that was a useful bit of information, because when you see the material that's written, even in the 1600s, and then certainly by the 1800s, there is no recognition that blacks were here when they arrived. So I found that really interesting. So that was Verrazano, the early explorer and pirate. Because I found some documents that said, well, if Verrazano was the first one to document the country, why wasn't it named after him? Or why didn't he get the credit that Christopher Columbus got? Because he was before Columbus, I believe. It was because he was a pirate.
Interesting.
Yeah, he was actually a pirate. So I find that fascinating.
I'm not surprised that they would actually write that piece of information out of history.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah,
because it's really about the who gets to tell the history, right?
Yeah,
and whether or not if you want to get people to think that they have no history, you make sure that you suppress whatever proof of history there is.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that whole economic system is based on suppressing that history.
It really is. And there are a few interesting people who stand out and have documented or at least put forth the hypothesis, mm-hmm, that is more supportive of the truth. There was this one gentleman, let me see if I can, his name was John Dennison Baldwin. Have you ever heard of John Dennison Baldwin?
No, I have not.
I had never heard of John Dennison Baldwin. Now, he's a European-American, but he was a member of the House of Representatives of Massachusetts, and he was in office from 1863 to 1869. And he was, I guess, he supported the equalizing of the whole anti-slave movement. He did not support the slave movement. He was about liberating people from slavery. And it was really interesting because he was also an anthropologist. And he wrote some interesting books. And one of them is called, let me see if I can find it, let me see, it's here somewhere. He wrote a book called, I'll find it in a minute, but essentially he wrote a book about are called Ancient America was one of the books. And the other one was called Prehistoric Nations, which I find really interesting, Prehistoric Nations. And this is a book. I have the PDF document of the book. And let me see if I can get to an interesting... Just the table of contents is really interesting. And it was published in Toronto, I think. Let's see. Or at least that's the ones who preserved the document. And what's really interesting is that he really looks at the connection between the civilizations in Africa and the civilizations of Europe and America. And so I find that really interesting that these people had written this history, and it's very difficult to find. Not impossible to find because I found it, but you'll see, you'll have to search over and over and over again to actually find the a source for it. You know, you'll hear that the book exists, but none of the source material seems to be available. But this book is, let's see, it's a lot of content. Okay, all right. Preliminary suggestions relative to the current chronologies, the relation of Hellas to civilization, and the meaning of prehistoric times. So basically, he's Hellenic society, I guess, and ancient society. And he talks about an early civilization in Arabia. Arabia was the ancient Ethiopia. So saying that it was actually Ethiopia that was there. Two races of Arabia. And it talks about the Kushite system of political organization, Kushite science, astronomical and nautical. Origin of the Phoenicians, and it talks about the Kushite religion and architecture. And Kush is really like Ethiopia. It's the ancient civilizations of Africa. But it's interesting because he's really making the connections between the modern societies, or so-called, that we think of, you know, Greek, Rome, Chaldea, as being the formative cultures. He's asserting that that's not the case, that these cultures are coming out of Egypt and Africa. And so I thought that was an interesting thing, that this book exists. It's by an archaeologist, but it's not readily available to most people. And I think that I'm just having fun with this because it's just so... The information is here, but finding it is another story. It's really another story. So it's tracing all these societies back to Africa, Arabia, the Berbers, it's really Northern Africa. And I just find that really fascinating that it's not just theory, but there's actual documentation of this information that exists, but the documentation has been very much suppressed. So I'm just having a good time with all this research and the quantity and the diversity of things that I'm finding is just, it's amazing. It's really amazing. I have some documents that talk about, that are actually court documents of like free blacks coming to the court complaining because, or someone else coming in saying, oh, he's not free, he's my slave, and I want him to be my slave. And then it talks about the whole proceedings of what happens to this person as a result of someone claiming them to be a slave. And then there are also documents that talk about how the rights of free coloreds keep getting reduced and reduced and reduced and reduced until legally they become slaves. So it's like their situation dramatically changes because of the legality of it. And I even downloaded a couple of documents in which people justify slavery. And you could see the same thinking in place now, because they're like, well, what, we have to have slaves because we need workers. And if we don't have slaves, then we have to make white people slaves because we still need workers. So we don't want to make poor white people slaves, so we have to keep black slaves. It was like, it's like really blatant, crazy thinking that people wrote books about and passed laws based on. Hmm. It's just fascinating.
Very fascinating.
American history, very fascinating. It's not what we learned in grade school at all.
No, I've been Von Sotomayor for you.
No, I definitely, yes.
No, I mean in school.
Oh, in school. Yeah. Oh, yeah, forget it.
They came forget before it. Columbus.
Well, Ivan Van Sertima, was saying that they came before Columbus, but they came so much before Columbus that they were just here, you know, because it wasn't a question of a couple of years earlier they managed to get here first, but no. Mm-hmm. But it's because they were trading. There was a lot of trade, and there was a lot of civilizations that came and stayed. Mm-hmm. And so when the whole colonization of the world began to take place, that whole process was interrupted. That integration and intermingling between continents was interrupted by the effort to colonize and exploit, really.
Hmm.
Interesting. So I'm wondering, how did they manage to explore the world, these Europeans, if the world was flat? Wasn't that about the same time period? What time period was it when the claim came out that the world was flat? Was that the 1500s, 1400s?
I'm not sure.
Me either.
I should know that, but I'm not sure.
Well, I guess anybody who went to school should know that.
I know.
But I have to say, I was daydreaming that day, staring out the window.
I guess I was too, and so, that's not good. But nonetheless.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. It's just all very, very interesting that the world is very different than we've been led to believe it is. So I just find that very interesting. I've also been looking at material about the lost continents of Lemuria and Atlantis, which most people consider to be myths. But there has been a lot of archaeological discovery of sites underground, you know, in the water, where they have pyramids and ruins and civilizations that have existed, and it's all underground. And so if we look through the millennia of time on our planet, you'll see that there's been a lot of shifting, and parts of the world that were under the ground came up, and things that were up went down. And we've been led to believe that civilization is very modern, but I actually believe that that's not the case. There's been civilization on this planet for many, 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 many more thousands of years than is being told or is being suggested. And at any rate, I found this other document that does talk about Lemuria and talks about how culturally similar the various indigenous peoples are around the globe. So, you know, like the Mayans, the Aztecs, the older civilizations in Egypt and in the continent of Africa, and even going north into Scotland and Ireland, there was a rather similar indigenous culture across the world. And so this person hypothesizes that when one of these continents went down, you know, people went across the world and set up civilizations in various places. So to me, that seems reasonable that that could have happened.
Yeah, it's logical. I mean, especially if you're witnessing that and there's a way to escape.
Mm. Yeah.
It's perfectly logical.
It's very logical that you would, because they were seafaring people. Mm. Ancient peoples. They probably didn't have the same kind of boats that explorers had with the big sails. Hmm. I think they probably depended more on currents.
Yes.
But they did. They were seafaring. So I just think it's interesting that our world is so, there's so much more to humanity than we ever really learn in school. And one of the things that's interesting is that we are led to believe that we are at the height of civilization. Looking on TV, I don't think anybody would think that. But if you're looking at any presidential campaign, it will call into question whether or not we're at the height of our civilization. But I actually think that humanity has devolved rather than evolved.
How?
Because I think in ancient civilizations, even though they may not have had the same technology that we have, they had technologies. And they had, for the most part, a tendency to live harmoniously with the land and with the environment, for the most part. And they had a much greater sense of on science of alchemy. I think they understood the solar system much more than we did. I think that they actually were aware of the connection of humanity and extraterrestrial races. If you look at a lot of the indigenous people, you know, the Hopi, the Dogon, they'll tell you that they are descendant from another planet, that their ancestors are on another planet, and that they came here, you know, and have been here, but they have mythology that takes them to the solar system, like Sirius, the planet Sirius. And if you look at a lot of ancient archaeology, especially a lot of the archaeology in India, you'll see flying machines. You'll see things that are flying. And if you look at their teachings, they talk about these wars that are taking place in the sky. So as modern humans, we tend to look upon all that as just myth or superstition. But I suspect that they're speaking about a reality that existed at one time. And so a lot of that took place before the civilization we're currently living in. So things descended to the point of people being, you know, living in caves, hunter-gatherers, and then having to evolve through a process yet again. So that's what I mean by history has reached height, and then for whatever reason fell, then another civilization reached a height and then falls. And so I think that we're living at that juncture of the fall of a civilization. I think we're devolving. I don't think humanity is devolving. I think our civilization is devolving. It doesn't work. It's non-functioning. It's destructive to the planet. It's destructive to each other, you know, warring, you know,
it's
insanity.
Self-destructive. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of a society collapsing on itself. So it at some point, I think that human beings will have to start over again and create a new civilization. I think we're very close to that juncture.
Hmm. I wonder what will happen at the point where it actually just goes poof.
It'll be interesting to figure that out. To see, I think we're seeing it. We're seeing it in slow motion. You know how when you're in an accident, things slow down?
Mm-hmm.
When I look at the world, to me it looks like it's collapsing now. All the structures are collapsing. The finances are collapsing. People can't really survive. It's very difficult for people to be able to, you know, have a good life and thrive. Everyone is, like, struggling to make ends meet, living in fear. And people are going crazy in large numbers and to a great extent. I think people are just losing it entirely. And so, to me, the only solution really is to really be very centered in oneself and not focused so much on the chaos. Because if you focus too much on the chaos, it just either makes you fearful or makes you crazy.
True. Yeah, that's all I can say.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not that it isn't chaotic, and it's not that we don't still have to keep moving and doing what we need to do, but what I'm suggesting is not to focus on the fact that our civilization is crumbling.
And I think, like the historians that you're describing, I think it's important that we have our own historians that can document the good, the bad, and the ugly as it all happens. Because hundreds of years from now, if the planet is still around and if there are people reading this stuff, they'll be reading what was written now.
Well, that's a frightening thought.
Well, because we're reading things from the 1500s.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. And I'm just wondering what's around. Well, there's a lot of good stuff around for people to read. You know, Richard Wolff was writing a lot of good stuff about the economy, and they're good, but it's probably going to have to be the same. People are going to have to search for the good stuff to find out what was really going on.
Yeah.
Very interesting. The number here is 718-780-8888. Again, that's 718-780-8888. Today I had the spiritual support group meeting. We meet every month, third Wednesday of the month. And so we had a nice gathering today, and people, you know, we're talking about some of these things, but not so much from the perspective of the documentation that I enjoy, but really just talking to each other about how to negotiate to maintain sanity in an environment that is really quite challenging to one's sanity. And I say that because the world doesn't really work. I think that there are jobs for people who want to get jobs, but not everybody can get jobs, and not everybody can get the kind of work that they have passion for or that they've been trained in. And I think that there are a lot of people who are really trying to just hold on, to keep a roof over their head, to feed their kids. Mm-hmm. And so people, they're in great numbers, are trying to figure out how to make it. And so what we were talking about are some of the things, alternative ways that people can begin to live through cooperative living, in the sense that, city gardening, roof gardening, making your own food, sharing things, supporting farmers and having food direct from farms, and creating, businesses that can sustain. So, we were talking on that level of finding ways to be sustaining and to support each other so that we can collectively create an economy that makes sense for people, to create a way of, either through barter or assisting each other, supporting each other's businesses. There are a lot of ways that people can help to sustain each other if we're not competing in the current marketplace and we're looking for alternative ways to thrive.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I can see that on a local level, you know. I think on a national level, it always remains an issue of international finance and trade. And I think that,
yeah,
along the lines of what you're saying, it quote-unquote fair trade or ethical trade or trade that... that considers the livelihood of the people who grow the food,
mm-hmm.
Without sabotaging them by heavily subsidizing your own so that you price them out of the market.
Yeah.
That's something that would be a very important and positive turn.
I totally agree with you. I don't know that that's going to happen, but I think it needs to happen. And I think we were really speaking less from a perspective of the political landscape, and we're looking at, you know, more how people can really just find ways to take care of themselves and their families and each other. Because I can look at the global markets now and it's very far away. I can't touch it. It's going to do what it's going to do. So I can't touch it, but it has an impact on my life. It has an impact on whether there's going to be products in the grocery store. It has impact on what those products are going to cost. And so there are all these systems that control our lives in a way. So, but I'm looking at ways to detach from that system so that if need be, people wouldn't need to starve to death. People wouldn't need to be without care, medical care, whatever it is, that, so that we could, if we look at what's available locally, what's being grown locally, and begin to build in systems that allow for us to less depend on the international market for basic survival needs. So, and I think that's what a lot of people are facing, really, because the quantities of people that are without work and without real... resources. There's a lot of people.
I know.
There's a lot of people who don't have what they need to get by.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that the government is really going to be able to handle that. And to me, it seems like something that people can begin to think about and strategize and create solutions in the now. While it's possible to create those solutions.
Okay.
That's my thought.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So let's play a little music.
Okay.
And then we'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned.
Freedom of speech, but we all talking at the same time. We say we want peace, but nobody wants to change their own mind. On and on and on and on and on for 1,000 years, 1,000 years, I say, and it goes.
was on and on and on and on and on. What language are your tears? Are your tears? Ba 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 da ba ba da ba 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 da ba ba da ba 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 da ba da. Everybody wants to live a life of kings and queens, but nobody wants to stay and plow the fields. Everybody wants to tell their neighbors how to live, but nobody wants to listen to how they feel. So it goes on and on and on and on and on for a thousand years. A thousand years, I say.
And you're listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And we're joined in studio by Matt, our WBAI volunteer extraordinaire. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
So you had some thoughts about what we were saying.
Yes, the de-evolution.
Bring the mic a little bit closer to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
The de-evolution of civilization.
Yeah.
Now, technologies. There were technologies in the past, and the fundamental of this is electricity. Now, electricity is very interesting. We take it much for granted. We just plug in our appliances and they go. But it has many other uses, many other ramifications. Electricity can be used to heal. If you look at the book of Robert Becker, The Body Electric,
mm-hmm.
He uses low voltage electricity to heal bones. You hook it up a certain way. Now, electricity, well, harp is another use, and that's borderline. One questions what the intention behind that is. That is millions of watts of electricity, radio frequency energy, being radiated into the atmosphere. I think it's used to control weather systems, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors used to use something called diathermy, which was a coil of wire with radio frequency energy. You put it over a limb, and it's supposed to be healing a joint. I don't know if that's still in use or how well it worked, but I remember reading about it, seeing it around in mm-hmm. doctors' offices. Many moons ago, thousands, millions of years ago, electricity was used to solve problems. You wanted to keep somebody in line, you zap them in certain ways with electricity, certain type of electrical gadgets, and you could implant suggestions into him. Today, in modern times, psychiatry might use this, an example of it, electroconvulsive therapy, which is someone who's unfortunate enough to undergo such an experience will tell you, wipes out your memory, it's supposed to be a cure for depression. It wipes out a memory and it fries part of your brain. And they have to strap you into a chair so you don't break bones. They use such a high voltage. But that's just my thoughts in this matter.
Electricity. Well, you know, human beings are electrical. We have electricity in our own bodies. And we respond, we can, you know, static electricity is one of the ways we feel zapped by electricity in a natural environment. But a lot of the energy healing can be thought of as a form of electricity or vibration that we carry in our own bodies. So I think that electricity is very powerful, but I think it's more useful when it's subtle. In terms of a healing modality, it would need to be very subtle. But electricity is not new to our civilization. They found electrical lamps in very strange places, like pyramids and stuff like that.
Oh, wow. One knows. Excuse me. You have more knowledge of that than I do. But I understand that. We do have electrical systems. The chakras are basically electrical systems. Mm-hmm. Chakra is actually a Sanskrit word. Chakra is a Sanskrit word which means wheel.
Mm-hmm. You want to get some water? You can get some water and come back.
Be right back.
Yeah, get some water. Bring me a cup too. Well, it's interesting about electricity. I guess, though, for me, technology isn't so much the marker of a civilization as what you do with it.
I agree. And I think that, and it's quite a commentary, actually, in terms of devolution of quote-unquote civilization, if you look at how technology is being used in weaponry. Today.
In weaponry, that's the real marker, isn't it? Because when you look at, split the atom and we started dropping nuclear bombs, it's been a long downhill slide.
Yeah.
Maybe not so long, but it has been a downhill slide. And we keep seeing science being used in a fashion that it becomes weaponized. So science is not bad. The technology is not bad. It's that it's being sequestered into the military-industrial complex and being used as weapons. So to me, that's really a sign of decline.
Yeah, that started a while back. Yeah. There was a very interesting, I think it was interesting, documentary that I heard recently on how military personnel have been used for all sorts of experimentation, and mm-hmm. including, I think it was in the 40s or the 50s, when they didn't know what PTSD was or how to treat it, mm-hmm. they would lobotomize people.
Wow.
To treat PTSD.
That is a fairly extreme response. A fairly extreme response. But I think that's part of the issue. Because when I think back to the days of Kennedy, President Kennedy, and how he was talking about going into space and all the things that we could do, it seems that so much that could have occurred, so many developments that could have happened, have been undermined for the purpose of weaponizing everything, turning everything into global conflicts. And so we have a situation where there's enough wealth in the world that every child should be cared for. You know, there's enough food that nobody should be hungry. And there's enough space that everyone could have shelter. Certainly there, if we were working towards advancements, there would be work because there'd be new technologies. But rather, there's been this effort to keep people into, this worker role, to just be, people are basically being educated to fulfill a role, a cog in the wheel in somebody else's economy, but not for their own economy. And so, to me, that's that greed and that manipulation and control is what has caused our civilization to decline. And I think there was a brief moment in American history where there was a dream of something else happening when the country was formed. But it was quickly plowed under with the, you know, striving for economic wealth and being willing to kill off an entire continent of people in order to inhabit the land. I mean, that's pretty severe stuff. It's pretty severe stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there are any other species on the planet that actually will murder each other for pleasure. That sort of level of, I guess you'd call it...
I'm not sure that it's or pleasure.
Well, maybe pleasure is the wrong word, but yeah. But with such a level of planning, I mean, it's just sort
yeah,
of this,
okay, yeah.
It's you know, I find that very disturbing in terms of, as you're saying, the devolution.
Yeah.
Of civilization.
You were going to say something. Do you remember what it was, Matt? Hold on.
Well, that was, I think what we're talking about now has to do with consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Take someone, an interrogator. He tortures people to get a response. You can't sit across from a person and turn thumb screws or whatever it is, see him scream, and have no reaction. If you're conscious, I think there's a high degree of unconsciousness. Even though a person looks like he's there, he looks like he's looking at you. Mentally, he is in another realm. He's just not seeing what's going on. To be able to cause that in another human being and have no reaction.
Yeah, I would say that
there's psychological terminology for that kind of behavior, isn't it?
I guess there is. What is it? I don't know what it is.
You know what when they describe as sociopaths?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, sociopaths and psychopaths, I suppose.
They have, like, no conscience over doing the most dastardly things to people. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well... It causes one to wonder how that happens, but I think that's part of the training that people undergo, military, not necessarily military training, but training. People are put through some mechanism that makes it possible for them to do things like that. But also, I think part of it is this underlying hatred that people cultivate within themselves makes it possible. Because when you look at the kind of things that took place during slavery, the kind of torture that people went through, and so there's something very disturbing going on for people to get to that level of, to have that capacity. I know during the days of slavery and Reconstruction, and even now, probably, you know, children are introduced to this thinking and this behavior very young. So back in the days of following slavery, primarily, you know, they would take children to lynchings. You know, they would take small children to these events,
yeah.
And they would witness these events,
yeah.
And so I think that there's a sort of a purposeful cultivation of that mentality that takes place, and it happens in deep military projects. I think there's a level of breaking of the spirit in any kind of military training, but when you get to the point of this kind of behavior, those people themselves had to have had their own humanity broken by something in order to be able to do that. I don't think it's a natural state.
It was a documentary, I forget the exact title, either The Good Soldier or Winter Soldier. You see, a military mentality personified. The guy is talking, he says, well, look, we're conducting a war, and if you're in the wrong house, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
This is, it's a mentality. I guess one could go through his life like that, you know, and you're a career military guy, and then you retire on a nice pension and smoke cigars or something.
Well, I think that there may be, that may be part of the scenario, but I think the greater part of the scenario is that people who are involved in that come back from that damaged. They don't come back to smoke a cigar. They come back to nightmares. The larger proportion of people who involve themselves in that war and that kind of behavior. I don't think it's so easy to recover from.
That is, if they even if they come back in one piece.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's a bigger machine. And it is true, I think, as long as someone is not being immediately encountering the threat. It's easy to talk like that. But it makes me wonder what because to me what happens generally, or what I've witnessed, is that this kind of attitude is fostered in soldiers. But once they've gone through the meat grinder of war, they don't necessarily maintain that kind of perspective. So I guess it's different for everybody. It's different for everybody. I mean, there's been war as far back as there's been civilization. So I'm not saying that, you know, that isn't the case. There has been war. But I think it does take a particular kind of sociopath or psychopath, to, like you said, to actually enjoy that, to actually, you know, to have the thrill of it.
Yeah, I mean, I've always seen, well, I mean, many years ago when I used to frequent internet cafes, I would watch these games that are free online, mm-hmm. that these young kids are playing, like sort of military war games,
yeah,
and how seductive it all is. And I see on television, you know, things that are meant for like PG-14, but they're actually showing you, you know, the thrill of blowing things up with people inside.
Yeah.
And so I can see how you can take someone who's just developing a sense of self at the age of 13, 14, 15,
mm-hmm.
and getting them sort of, I don't want to use the word hooked, but used to that kind of scenario, that sort of something that appeals to that part in them, mm-hmm. to sort of, here's the enemy, annihilate the enemy. And to do that enough, to make the game so seductive that the kid wants to play this 24 hours a day or something like that,
and
does something to you.
Well, I think it's a societal thing, because it also leaks into everything.
Sure.
So people competing in a workplace are going to want to annihilate each other. People competing on a sports field are going to want to annihilate each other. It's mm-hmm. a mentality that's very present in our society today.
Yeah.
And you're right, it starts very, very young, that people get shaped into it. But even on the video games, you don't actually encounter real death. And so I think that's part of what why so much warfare has switched to drones and, you know, sitting in a comfortable room in a country, and you're just operating the equipment and sending it And I think that's what these games have led to, that kind of operation of that kind of technology, so that people don't actually see the blood and the death and the gore that they're responsible for. So it's easier to be detached. But when people are on the ground and they're shooting at each other and they're watching their friends fall and they're taking the lives of other people, it has a much deeper visceral impact on that person, and they become more damaged by that act, I think. But how do we devolve into this conversation? I don't know. But
the evolution of civilization.
Yeah. So, but you're right. But just as the video games and the confrontation and the violence gets introduced and inculcated at a very young age, other more coherent, conscious processes can be introduced to children as well. And I think that's what it really will take to change things, to shift things around, so that kids can, I mean, and that's one of the things I think that older societies, ancient civilizations had. There was a different nurturing of young people than we see today. And I mean, even in my grandparents' generation, my parents' generation, people were relationship to children were different because they had time to actually relate to kids. Nowadays, parents barely have time to spend with their kids. They're usually working, and kids don't get the same kind of nurturing direction that they might have gotten in some years ago, to some degree.
It's more attention,
yeah,
or structure.
Yeah.
Well, that has to do with, see, Rick Wolf, in his brilliant analysis of our economy over the last 150 years, you know, he just describes, for a while, wages were rising, and then as technology came in, jobs disappeared, they didn't need, and people had to work longer and longer hours because the wages stopped rising, because they didn't need so many people to work because of technology, automation. So, and when this happened, what did people do? When wages stopped, right, work more hours to maintain their lifestyle. And when that didn't work, they started borrowing the credit card. And now people are working so many hours, two jobs, they don't have time for children. You know, this relates to the economy, what happened. The other issue is people questioning. People don't question what they're taught. You go to your university and you're given this information. And one never inspects it. Is this true? Is this not true? And philosophy is supposed to teach you how to do this. And I don't know how many philosophy courses people take these days. But, for instance, I remember in school, we were taught the business cycle. And the business cycle says once every 20 years, you have to have a war for the economy. You know, you have growth, prosperity, then you have a recession, depression, and then you have a war to get you out of it. This is what we were taught. Does one ever ask himself, is this necessary? Is this true? Is this a real cycle? Is there any other way of doing it? And this is true in many other subjects. You go into medicine, for example, and Bonnie Faulkner, this morning she had on Guns and Butter, Dr. Joel Wallach, and he was saying how misinformation is introduced into the medical community, the Flexner Report in the early 1900s got rid of all these alternative therapies and introduced all this misinformation about cholesterol and saturated fat. And people are on these statin drugs to reduce the cholesterol when it's vital to make vitamin D and many other physical processes. And he enumerates all these diseases and conditions from deficiencies in cholesterol and saturated fat. So now, does one ever question this in going through his medical education? Or is it just monkey see, monkey do kind of thing?
I think there's a lot of monkey see, monkey do. And also, especially in medicine, the structure is such that you can't get through it without accepting what they tell you. So if you want a medical degree, then you accept what they tell you. But I think the real important thing is for, like you said, for doctors to begin to question it. And I think there have been many who have questioned what the medical profession is teaching. But I think that you're right, that everything, we're living in a sea of corporatism. Everything in our world is based on profit. Everything is based on how is this going to be marketed and sold. And so if you can heal yourself with something that costs $2, it's not going to sustain an industry. So the industry has rewritten itself so that it can profit from the illness that people have. And so that's part of the problem. That's part of the problem. And then they've created these regulatory agencies that over the years have gone after doctors who would question it. So it does become a challenge. The real answer is people being educated to the truth. Consumers have so-called. I say so-called because that's how people are thought of in the world, as consumers, not as human beings, but as consumers. But if we're intelligent and can make informed choices, I think that's the quickest way to change things.
Well, I think there's also right now a movement across the country at medical schools to actually do away with the old form of teaching, mm-hmm. and come up with original, more holistic approaches to teaching medical professionals. And so I don't know when this movement started. I think it was relatively recent, probably within the Obama administration, where these schools are basically rewriting their curriculum. Mm-hmm. They, for instance, medical doctors aren't taught anything about nutrition. How can you study the body and not study nutrition? And so their efforts to consult with nutritionists, you know, to have the medical faculty sit down and sort of get their take on what should be included in a curriculum for, I guess you call them, physicians of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, what should we look at, you know, social activism in medicine and, you know, the political as it affects health. Mm-hmm. There are things that are happening where I think my sense is that because of this sort of prescribed way of teaching medicine that's probably about 100 years old, now that that's starting to fall apart, you're kind of getting the real voice of doctors who've been basically, you know, doing what they're told or teaching how they've been told that they have to teach because of this, you know, prescribed curriculum that was the same across the country, standardized. Mm-hmm. And now that that's changing, they're basically able to say what's on their mind. And so it's an interesting kind of phenomenon to see in some cases up close, you know, where you hear doctors talking about how, you know, that they were always constricted to spending X amount of time with patients when they really wish they could spend much longer time, which would give them more quality service or quality care. So those things are coming out. And I mean, I'm hoping that the end product will be something that's far better than what we've seen in terms of everything, in terms of, you know, medical experimentation, in terms of informed consent, in terms of research with communities of color, also in terms of professors who are just honest about the bias that exists and the mm-hmm. relationship with companies that that affect their judgment, the mm-hmm. pharmaceutical companies that affect their judgment in terms of how to treat a patient. So there are professors who are out there who say those things and are proposing that the curriculum includes work where students have to understand what those biases have been, that they're very real, and those and that they go out enlightened, and they're not just sort of sequestered away away from the communities that they're surrounded by.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm somewhat optimistic about what I'm seeing, but clearly I have to sort of see what happens over the next 10, 20 years, if I'm around that long, to see whether or not this is really going to take hold and what kind of change it produces. But the mere fact that they are doing this, that they are shaking things up, I think is a very positive thing.
I'll give you positive. I don't have the patience, though. In a sense, you know, things happen that way. It takes time to slowly lumber through and make shifts in the structure of medicine. And I think it's good that people are beginning to acknowledge that it needs to change. But how many people are going to die in the next 10 years because waiting for them to make up their minds?
Well, actually, it's moving quickly. For instance, in certain medical schools, one that I know fairly well, that new curriculum is going to be taught come September 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're in med school for how many years, you know, just imagine the people who will be graduating from that class
mm-hmm.
going out in the world. So it's actually happening faster than one would think.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So I'm going to play another piece of music, and then we shall be back.
Don't worry, Mother. It'll be all right. Don't worry, Sister. Say your prayers. Sleep tight, it'll be fine, lover of mine, it'll be just fine. Lend your voices only to sounds of freedom. You wish to be free from, fill lies with love and bravery, and you shall lead a life uncommon. I've heard your anguish, I've heard your heart's cry out. We are tired. Your voices.
but if praying were enough, it would have come to be. Let your words enslave no one, and the heavens will hush themselves to out of the way. There is a new army coming, and we are armed with faith. To live, we must give. To live. And
that was Jewel, Life Uncommon. We heard earlier, Is Love Enough by Michael Franti and Spearhead. And our opening theme by Michelle Indiocello, Earth. I believe that's what we've played so far. But we were just talking about how difficult it is sometimes to change that paradigm. But I think that's what it's going to take, is for everyone to change the paradigm on how, and their framework of how we think of life and think of reality. And that will help us, I think, once this civilization really crashes down, if we can operate out of these new paradigms, like the school you were speaking of already, thinking about how it's educating doctors. But I think we have to rethink how we even look at our lives and how we think of ourselves, and just change the paradigm. I think that we are too plugged in to the existing framework. People are not able to relax. People are not able to rest. People are not able to focus on self-care because they're too concerned about being able to survive in a system that's basically designed that they don't make it. The system, as it's currently working, is very predatory. And people who may have worked their whole lives and done everything right are facing a seniorhood, an older life, without having resources, without having... the investments in retirements are gone. Social Security is being pulled, and it's not enough. People are not able to afford. You know, people are in so much debt, their loans for their houses, their education loans, their kids' loans. And so the people are so rolled up into the madness of our current society that madness is making us sick, because people are so invested in that. So we have to change our paradigm and and begin to walk away from that system. I don't see any other real answer.
Well, the only thing I could suggest is try to take a walk. Walk among trees, grass.
Well, yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, that is true. You can do a lot to heal yourself, and that's part of walking away from it. So a person who can't escape their own thoughts is kind of what I'm saying. So it's not just that the system is pressuring people. People are in debt. People are worried about their survival. But it goes deeper than that, in that the thoughts never move from that space. So we're always thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? How am I going to survive? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I can't relax because I've got this cloud hanging over me. I can't move forward because I have this, and this is not working. And so what happens is that the system is inciting in us to individually become our own tormentors and our own jailers. And so in walking away from the system, you know, you may still be needing to work, have a job, but to walk away from the ideology, the thinking, the stress and the pressure that it imposes, and begin to live life, like you say, Matt, walking in nature, being able to have a level of peace of mind without worrying about the next bill, without worrying about, how are you going to get by? Because ultimately what happens is that people get by for the most part. So you can spend a year working hard and being stressed out, or you could spend a year working hard and not being stressed out. So to me, that we have to unplug emotionally, unplug psychologically, and begin to bring that attention inward, so that we can rebuild our internal level of awareness, our internal appreciation for who we are, for each other, so that we can create space for ourselves. People don't create space for themselves until it's too late. They're either broken down physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, and it's in that breakdown, when people just can't go on, that they begin to seek out space for themselves. And while that's all well and good, that's how a lot of us got there. I certainly did. But I think the pressures have become so intense that the only real solution is to retreat from it, unplug from it, and allow ourselves a chance to breathe, allow ourselves a chance to enjoy life, and to remember what it means to really enjoy life. And being at risk, or like not having a job, or not having, knowing where you're going to lay your head, is not the best situation to be in. But at the same time, there's a way in which we can not be our tormentors in that situation, our own tormentors, so that we can use that mental and emotional energy to apply towards a solution. I think people don't realize how much stress and worry takes away from one's capacity to be creative and to resolve and to solve things. So there needs to be an unplugging from the system, at least mentally, so that we can go on and be happy, despite not having much. That's my thought. Anyway, it's time for us to think about making space for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. And we have him on recording this morning, so we'll be playing that momentarily. But any last thoughts you want to share, or emotions, feelings, desires, hopes, dreams? I'm stacking up a list, and you're going like, well, maybe I had an idea to start with, but now.
Well, I say one of the advantages of modern technology is they can't, whoever these powers are, they can't control all the information. I mean, they can't stop all the good information, and it's readily available. That is a big plus. And there is a lot of good information available. There are a lot of resources now, a lot of good books that people are writing, a lot of good articles on the internet, a lot of videos. There's plenty of educational materials. So you are much more able to educate yourself. And that's what needs to happen. People have to get into the mindset of you're educating yourself. It's just like, I guess someone could have the mindset that, well, I'm going to a university, they're going to educate me. Reverse that mindset. I'm educating myself. I'm getting assistance from the faculty and staff of this university. It's like Dr. Ali says.
We're out of time.
Okay.
But it's a very good point. Did you want
to... Well, I think that it's important. It's not easy to do because people, I think a lot of things require a certain amount of leisure time. It takes leisure time to do research, to sort of dig through things. And I guess my sense is that it's so important to maintain a sense of critical thinking. That, you know, I think that that's what those powers are terrified of. People who actually question things. Mm-hmm. And that upsets them when people question things. But I think that's the reason people should continue to question things on whatever level that's possible. But it's not an easy thing to do. It takes time that a lot of people just don't have in their day. And so you have to have a certain amount of understanding that people are intelligent, but they may not be informed.
Right. Well, no, I totally agree with you there. We could discuss this more had we more time. Mm. But as it is, we're going to move to the next program. I want to thank all of you for joining us at this morning for Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And here we go.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, we will have an interview with Elizabeth Crowens, conducted last Wednesday at the Mysterious Bookshop, and a slate of movie reviews from Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Warcraft is, and I take no pleasure in saying this, Warcraft is a god-awful mess wrapped in a load of hooey. I'd actually written a more fecund term than hooey there, but no, hooey, antiquated a word as it is, does sum up the level of consequence of this film quite well. This is especially disappointing since the director, Duncan Jones, has rapidly built a name for himself with such films as Moon and the underappreciated time travel story Source Code, films that took small-scale productions and put big ideas into them. Warcraft inverts the formula, giving Jones a big and admittedly beautiful and impressive palette to work with, but shrinking the ideas down to something that wouldn't be out of place in a sword and sorcery home video release. An uneven, at times incomprehensible, sword and sorcery release at that. A key aspect of this film is something called the Fell. It gets referred to throughout. I sat through 2 hours of this thing, and I'm still not sure what the Fell is. For about half the film, I thought it was some kind of tribe recruited by the film's orc villain to fight his battles against the humans. That I got from a sequence where a wizard uses magic to vaporize some of the orc attackers while leaving others, the good orcs obviously standing, and one of those orcs exclaims, "The Fell!" But that assumption turned out to be wrong. The Fell is some kind of force, apparently, but if it's a conscious entity thirsting for power or just a serious case of bad vibes, I couldn't tell you. And in the end, I didn't care. Jones tries to invert some cliches, giving us orcs with a sense of morality for one, but that just leads to more confusion as he tries to reconcile the deeper emotional beats of these creatures with their use as an implacable invasion force. It can be done, but the director hasn't found the equation here. I like Jones. I respect his intelligence and ingenuity. Those were sadly thwarted by Warcraft. When you can get a more compelling mise-en-scene from any episode of Adventure Time, then your epic fantasy is in big trouble. And unfortunately, there are a couple of films that I missed the release dates of, but I do want to make note of them because they are worth your attention. Hopefully they'll come around again on home video or elsewhere. The Fitz is an unusual coming-of-age film about a young girl who seeks admission into her school's dance team, just as the older girls begin to be stricken one by one by a wave of unexplained seizures. Director Anna Rose Homer manages to mix a documentary-like reality the film is set and was shot in Cincinnati with a unique metaphor for a child who stands at the threshold of adulthood and looks toward the future with both fear and longing. It's a fascinating and heartfelt film. Reality and fantasy clash as well in Mad Tiger, a documentary about the comedic rock band P. Lander Z, a kind of cross-cultural mashup of punk music and Japanese Sentai superhero TV shows. The film is less a career review and more a record of the band and its founders Kengo Hayoki and Kotaro Kusada as they confront a significant and possibly devastating crossroad in their future, as members decide to step away from their lives of impersonating benevolent musical aliens. Directors Michael Hartline and Jonathan Yee manage to capture the surprisingly serious consequences behind the actions of a bunch of guys who spend their evenings cavorting on stage in tacky, color-coded superhero get-ups. Turns out, even unabashed silliness can extract a high emotional toll. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
And once again, good morning. By way of disclosure, I should mention that for me, it's actually afternoon. I'm pre-recording this material the afternoon before broadcast. Our main feature this morning is an interview conducted with Elizabeth Crowens last week at the Mysterious Bookshop in Tribeca, downtown Manhattan, on the occasion of the debut of her first novel, Silent Meridian. which features one of the characters in the book as Arthur Conan Doyle, and, in a manner of speaking, in the person of Teal James Glenn, Sir Arthur joined us. So now you set your way back machine and join us as well.
Thank you all very much for coming to the Mysterious Bookshop tonight. For those of you who don't know us, we've been in business for 37 years. We are the oldest mystery bookshop in the country. We are located here at 58 Warren Street, and you can also find us online at mysteriousbookshop.com. Tonight, we are here to celebrate the release of Silent Meridian, which is Elizabeth Crowan's first novel. And it features the iconic Sir Arthur Conan Doyle on a cross-worlds adventure. It's pretty exciting, and I think you guys will be delighted with it. We're also joined tonight by Jim Freund, who is the producer of Hour of the Wolf on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Okay, so, now let me explain something. This is in the form of a radio program, and this is a radio program. We are not yet, we are in fact recording and filming and all that good stuff. But basically, I do a weekly program that's been on the air since, God help me, 1972, and called Hour of the Wolf. It's primarily about science fiction, but this falls into that. But I will say that I've also covered the Edgar Awards and stuff, so there's lots of mystery crossover. And so what this actually is, as the way Elizabeth initially proposed it, is this is an episode of my program. Okay, so I am your host, and I will begin, and I will do introductions and things like that. I will then introduce the mysterious Sir Arthur, and after we'll start with a short interview, then the reading, then a longer interview, some Q&A, and an epilogue. But I will ask you to treat this as if it were a broadcast studio. Yes, I can edit. I'd rather not have to. And all that means is, number one, please put your phones to vibrate. And if you ask a question, if you talk, this is facing this way. It will not hear you. So even if the question is for Sir Arthur or an actor, if there should be one in the house, or for Elizabeth, please address it in a manner that either Elizabeth or I can then reiterate your question so it will end up on the air. So so I think that's basically it. And having said that, you're rolling. At any rate, hello, welcome. This is, so I'm going to